On June 20th, the National Basketball Association will hold its annual draft. Duke University freshman Zion Williamson is the projected number one draft pick. Some basketball experts say the 6'7", 285-pound, 18-year-old from South Carolina will be the next LeBron James. All of the major sneaker companies are competing to sign Zion to endorse their products. It's been rumored that he could be the first athlete to sign a $100 million shoe deal straight out of college. Sneakers have come a long way since that old canvas Chuck Taylor Converse of yesteryear. Thanks to companies like Nike, Adidas, Reebok, and Under Armour, sneakers have revolutionized sports from youth leagues to the pros. Sneakers have changed the fashion industry, music, and American popular culture. From a purely financial standpoint, in the global athletic footwear market size is expected to reach $95.14 billion by 2025, according to a new report by the Grand View Research Incorporated. There are sneaker conventions held nationwide where sneakerheads converge to trade sneakers and look for the newest pair of kicks. A rare pair of sneakers worth $200 can go for as much as $12,000 on the resale market. Joining me today are two men who've been involved in the sneaker industry for more than a decade. My first guest is Gene Smith. Gene was the captain of the 1984 Georgetown University basketball team, the Hoyas, which featured NBA Hall of Famer Patrick Ewing. That team won the national championship in 1984. Gene went on to work with Nike's Jordan brand for over 20 years, and he now consults with Adidas. Also joining me on the line is Mr. Drew Greer. Drew is a brand builder and the co-founder of Storytelling Agency. He has experience working with Under Armour, Nike, and Ralph Lauren, just to name a few brands. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here.
Gene, you're a native of Washington, D.C., and Drew is a native of Los Angeles, California. So both of you all were honored by the Smithsonian recently for your work in the sneaker industry. What was that specific honor, and what did it mean to you all?
First of all, was the African-American Footwear Forum had our first conference, and they recognized our contributions to the sneaker industry, people of color. My side on the product side, as well as sort of the brand and storytelling side, and then Gene Smith on product development, as well as from a sales standpoint, a lot of the things that he sort of architect within the industry.
And for me, the award couldn't come at a more timely time. So just being recognized in terms of our contributions was important, because a lot of it's behind the scenes, and a lot of it goes unnoticed. So it was definitely an honor to be recognized.
And Drew, you mentioned the storytelling side of the sneaker industry. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that means? Like, how do shoes tell a particular story?
It basically comes down to any brand, any product, even us as individuals. The story is everything. I mean, people are buying experiences. And from a storytelling standpoint, it could be technology. It could be inspiration from an athlete, inspiration from a product. But you want to get that to the consumer, so they're able to speak into it and share that. And that's when you're really building something of legacy status.
Growing up, what types of sneakers did you guys wear? Like, do you remember your very first pair of really coveted and special shoes?
So this is Gene. My first pair of sneakers, you mentioned the old school Chuck Taylor. So I'm growing up in the 70s, and the Chuck Taylor canvas was the shoe that I remember first wanting to have. But then I caught a bit of the Nike bug with the Nike Bruin suede in the late 70s. But the pinnacle for me, because I had somewhat of a basketball career as a player in high school, was the Adidas shell toe high top. And that's a shoe that you polished and you washed after every game and you kept clean, but that was my game-only shoe.
I mean, my perspective is a little different, even though we're about five years sort of age difference in sort of D.C. versus L.A. There's some similar paths. my intro, actually, I'm a former football player, played at Ohio University. My first intro was the spot-built Juice Mobile, OJ signature shoe. It was sort of my first signature shoe, and I was actually from a Cleveland. I obviously wasn't wearing that, you know, on a flow basis, but same thing. Chuck Taylor was my intro into signature shoes. Prior to that, I was in Kenny's NBA. And we sort of joke locally. Those were the fake Converse. and then my first leather shoes were actually leather Bruins, and that was another stage. And I was going from $20 to $40. That was a major purchase. So my mother paid for half, and I had to hustle to get the other $20.
Drew, not to cut you off, I'm glad you mentioned the price. Because today you look at the price of sneakers, and a $200 price point is common if you want a nice pair of shoes. And some go for $220, $300. $100 is pretty cheap. But you were saying when you were a kid, to spend $40 was a lot of money for a pair of sneakers?
It's all based on scale and status. I mean, what, you know, the economy was then, as well as the currency of what a sneaker is and its acceptance. Mm-hmm. You know, before it was very gym-based. Then it became very cultural-based, and the industry changed, and that's, you know, you're speaking into the billions. And that's the same thing as related to the sort of the lifestyle. Then technology and other things sort of enhanced. So the prices have progressed much like, you know, a gallon of milk.
Would you guys consider yourselves to be sneakerheads?
We're athletes.
Okay.
So there's a difference.
Okay.
You're a sneakerhead. Yeah, ex-athletes. I mean, yeah. But no, we have a body, but figure from our perspective, we talk about this all the time. When we grew up, you could not play the sport and have the flyest kicks. You had to be an athlete. It's like the NBA socks. Like, how dare you go on a court with NBA socks, which were hard to obtain, and not have game. So it had to come with something. But hip-hop and other things culturally, there's no complaints, and we're no better, but made it so that the fans could have an expression point as well.
Yeah, it's gone from the actual person having the experience wearing the best stuff or performing in the best stuff, that now it's a, you know, multi times over billion-dollar industry, and that accessing that experience comes via the product.
And Gene, while you were at Georgetown, you had your own sneaker, like you guys, I believe, were the first college team to have your own signature shoe. Was that correct?
While I was there, we actually launched the Air Force One product in 1982. And I mention that because my esteemed colleague built that product, that Air Force One product, into something that changed the dynamics of the game in the late 80s, or maybe early 90s, mid 90s. So the Air Force One was a shoe that we were dubbed to wear, but because our top player at that time was Mr. Ewing, that product didn't work for him. We actually went back to a non-air shoe. The signature shoe that you speak about came about a few years later in 1985 with the Terminator that actually had the Hoyas on the back. So it was signature in that zone. I think that was the first time, and Drew probably could speak to that better than me. That might have been the first time that they put a college name or logo on the back of a product.
Yeah, other schools had it with other brands. That's the first time, sort of. No, actually, Nike was the first, and then others soon followed suit. I think Kentucky with Converse and some others. But it was a memorable moment, and actually, the shoe was specific to Georgetown. That was the difference. Others had had brands, but this shoe was designed specifically for the Hoyas in mind, and John Thompson sort of thinking ahead. And they had, you know, won that sort of status just based on the national championship and how they sparked the sneaker industry because of their connection with all of urban black communities throughout the U.S. and eventually the globe.
Right, and ladies and gentlemen, he just mentioned John Thompson as coach, John Thompson Jr., who was the head coach of the Georgetown Hoyas basketball team during that time period. Sonny Vaccaro, just briefly, can you guys just say who he was and how he played a role in this?
Sonny's really thought was creative thinking as well as really on the grassroots standpoint. He developed the college endorsement program that eventually became the signature piece. really building Nike basketball, and then split, went to Adidas and made major impact there, you know, Kobe and Tracy and some of the others. You know, grassroots level on the heart of the game, some of the best tournaments and all-stars.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to UMES 30. We are talking today with two men who have decades worth of experience in the sneaker industry. We have Gene Smith, and then we also have Mr. Drew Greer. So, Gene, you were at Nike, you know, so after Georgetown, you go to Nike, and you were at Nike from the beginning of its Jordan brand, the signature sneaker for NBA legend Michael Jordan. Hulu has a new documentary, which actually came out last year, but it's on Hulu now, about the history of the Air Jordan 1. And in the film, it depicts Nike's signing of Jordan in 84 as a watershed moment, because this was the first time you had a dark-skinned black man as the face of what will become a global brand. It also, in the film, talks about how, you know, there was this urban legend about the first shoe from Jordan being banned by the NBA, and how that made the sneaker much more, like, coveted by young people who really kind of saw this as like a symbol of anti-establishment and revolution. So from your perspective, what's the true story of the Jordan brand's iconic rise to, you know, star status?
All of what you said, remnants of truth. It was definitely a watershed moment on multiple levels and multiple fronts. Nothing that I think could be scripted. It's one of those stories that the more you tell it, and the more people trying to solely claim responsibility for it, the more it becomes just an old wives' tale. So for me, I started at Nike in 1986, and that's important from the standpoint that I think Jordan had already released his shoe. He came out in the 84 draft. So his shoe was already, you know, starting off. So Jordan 1 was 85. The NBA did ban a color. He also got injured, I think, that in his second year or part of his first year. The point being is you had all of these moving variables, moving parts, but you also had a guy who at the time won the NCAA championship, had, you know, he was an alpha guy. His style, his dress, the way he played, levity in the air. You had all these dynamics working, and he came along at the right time. It was almost like a Barack. It was like a Barack moment. Hmm. You know, it's like he just came along at the right time. Just watching the evolution of the product and the brand and the acceptance from the community is something that, you know, no one story can tell.
From a political standpoint, Jordan during his playing career was always very quiet. So if Jordan was an athlete today and he was on social media, the fact that he's not as outspoken as let's say LeBron James, right, on a number of issues that are really important to the culture, do you think that would hurt his bottom line when it comes to selling shoes? Or would it be more of a case like you had with Kanye West at Adidas, where as long as the shoes are hot, people could kind of look past the politics or the lack of politics and say, well, hey, we want to wear these shoes regardless because they're hot and we like you?
I think the story, his on the court would carry enough weight and validity that he could remain neutral at best. But I do think, in today's climate, he would be required, or would be advantageous to him and his brand to have some type of messaging to ask those things, to answer or to respond to those things that move the culture. So yes and no. You know, the deal with Kanye is, you know, I like the fact that he referenced himself as an athlete in terms of his when he does a concert and the physical that goes into that, and you know what he's done with Adidas in terms of making that brand, you know, being a part of making them relevant again, or as relevant as they are now. But I don't think that's a comparison in terms. But it is a comparison in terms of cultural relevance. Yes, but I think he would he would have to respond more, and he would be held more accountable to some degree. Mm-hmm. And that would be my answer.
When I was a kid growing up, one of the things I would remember was whenever the Jordans came out, it was a real big deal. It was almost a moment in the community. And at one point, there was a lot of talk in the media about the violence that was associated with the sneaker. Sports Illustrated had a cover story in the late 80s, early 90s. And in the story, it talked about a number of young men, young boys who were shot and killed for their Jordans. And even more recently, within the last 10 years, Nike would always have a big drop. They still do it. They'll have a big drop around Thanksgiving or Christmas for a pair of retro Jordans, and people go wild for those shoes. And things are a little more under control now, but about 10 years ago when these shoes would drop, you would see on the news kids stampeding at shopping malls, and you would hear about this kid literally just bought a pair of Jordans for $200, and he was walking to his car and got mugged right there in the parking lot. Speak to this, like this issue of the violence. What's causing the violence? And is it the responsibility of these shoe brands, whether it's Nike, Adidas, whoever, to do more to prevent this violence?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, obviously, when you're building a brand, you want to build demand. So that's gold. But I think there's a parenting issue. I think there's a security issue. I think there's a, managing the consumer experience issue. I think there's a lot of things that package end is sort of addressing that. But I don't think it's of accuracy to put all of that on the sneaker brands.
So I think, to Drew's point, it's not just one thing that you could point at, but there needs to be more of a collaborative and collective effort.
There's a documentary film called Behind the Swoosh. It was about this young man who was a coach at St. John University, and then he left because he, was angry that Nike was exploiting workers somewhere in East Asia, I believe. And, he went over there and he did this big expose, and, he's talking about the Nike sweatshops. And, he talked to Phil Knight, and, in the video, Phil Knight didn't really seem all that interested in doing anything about it. So we hear about that, but then we also hear about exploitation back home in the States, where you're talking about college coaches who make a lot of money from shoe deals, and their players wear these shoes, but the players don't get any compensation for it. Or we hear about the sneaker industry and its involvement with youth sports and AAU, and how you have some kids who will pick the high school they go to. I know my former high school, DeMatha, has a pretty lucrative shoe deal. They'll pick a high school or they'll pick a college based on the sneaker that endorses that school. So and then we also hear about these scandals. That there are recent reports about scandals with folks who worked at Adidas, folks who worked at Nike. As people who are in the shoe industry, what do you think about like these accusations that the sneakers are exploiting our workers and exploiting our young people and ruining colleges?
I guess that you need a whole episode for this this topic. But what I will respond to is the system, the whole amateur athletic union, whatever that means, has not evolved. So exploitation from the student athlete has ran amok and is rampant. The brands play a role. The NCAAs play a role. The parents play a role. The kids play a role. Everybody has a role to play, and everyone's pointing fingers where they need not. The agents have a role. The NBA has a role. And I'm saying all this to say that the money has escalated and is at an all-time high. And those who produce that are the product are not being compensated fairly on the amateur level. And how that can be addressed is, those who, there are enough basketball minds, and there are enough families, there are enough on every level, collegiate, high school, you know, this thing starts even earlier now. So I think it just needs to be addressed in a 21st century manner. And it certainly is not representative of those that work for these unions. Those that work for the NCAA do not reflect those who have actually participated in college athletics. So I just think the system needs an overhaul. Because what's taking place now in terms of people doing jail time over something that amounts to a cup of coffee. The rules are outdated, and then you have, you know, those who have prospered the most from the rules never being held accountable. So this is not about anything other than the system's outdated.
To me, it's even more than a system; it's an ecosystem. I have a whole movement called "The Sneaker Industry Must Die." D-I-E. I'm devoted to this from an internal perspective, but all of it's interrelated. But DIE, D-I-E, stands for diversity, inclusion, and empowerment. Within the sneaker industry, let's just use analytics, because to me that's where everything sort of starts, is blacks make up 13% of the population. But from an industry standpoint, we probably influence over 50% of this, you know, mega billion-dollar industry, and it isn't reflected from an employee standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, from a senior leadership standpoint, from a board standpoint. One of the questions I pose is, why aren't there any members of hip-hop, former athletes, on any of these boards? If you look at the founding fathers of sneaker culture, because the industry went from a sporting goods industry and equipment to a culture industry, it's Georgetown basketball, it's Michael Jordan, who came after Georgetown basketball, and Run-DMC. It took this thing so that it became over-indexed as it relates to consumption or people rocking the product beyond what it's sort of designed for. And this isn't reflected. You know, from an economic inclusion, there are 15 black retailers, sneaker retailers, in the whole world. We need to make sure we preserve them. And the brands can keep them open by giving them the correct product and developing the correct strategies to give them a correct lane. But, you know, they shouldn't trade us out of the equation. And they need to enhance as relates to developing the team. Because, you know, the last point, you know, so it's diversity, you know, which is a numbers game. And then there's the inclusion. So diversity is getting invited to the party. Inclusion is getting asked to dance. So that's getting you into, you know, decision-making meetings and more of an advanced sort of part of the equation. And then there's the E, which is the empowerment, which is new, is we want power. We want to be party planners. We want to set strategies and really build teams and really provide a perspective, because it's all interrelated. It's in the best interest. This is the right thing to do. It's the best thing to do as it relates to advancing the game. And with the progression of the consumer, I think this becomes more important. And as it relates to looking at it from an analytical standpoint, because that's what the world is about today, it's very clear. And typically naiveness is used to sort of, you know, being why things are in the state. So I'm a fan of, you know, let's be color bold and let's have a discussion and let's keep it at an emotionally intelligent level. And let's create an action plan and let's review that action plan to make sure we're addressing it on all these levels. So that's the goal, but right now it's in a very awareness page. I mean, stage. There's a DIE Sneakers Instagram that I have devoted to it that I'm feeding content into with others. But, it's a movement that needs to be addressed. And our community, there's no other community that we've had probably bigger influence on. And I think that same investment, as well as nurturing of talent, of partners and vendors, with 15 black sort of retail, even just consultants. On all levels, we should be a part of this. And because it started off as a sporting goods industry, and as Gene sort of stated, things are dated, we need to look at the books and address everything for the sake of the industry.
We didn't touch on the in terms of industry practices, people working for minimum wage or less than minimum wage, or humanity issues across the globe. But there is no brand that's sacred in that regard.
Right.
But I do think practices and standards have been improved immensely. And I saw that on a personal level during the latter part of my career at Nike.
Drew, in 2015, you were serving as a global vice president of product merchandising for Under Armour. How important is Under Armour to the sneaker industry today? Do you see it surpassing Nike and Adidas at some point soon?
I think Under Armour is in a state of defining who they are.
Okay.
Looking in the mirror and developing a culture that reflects that. So it'll be very important to see how this pivot plays out.
Okay. And Gene, you're now with Adidas after many years over at Nike. So we talked earlier about Kanye West being at Adidas. You have Pharrell. You see Adidas using a lot of non-athletes now. I hear there's a deal with Beyonce. Is that the trend now you see in terms of Adidas? It's less about the athletes and it's more about these cultural influencers and these musicians leading the brand?
I think that's a strategy that they've been successful with. I also think they have on their roster as well. But I think if you look at their business, the Originals, which is their lifestyle portion of their business, has spearheaded their growth the last 3 to 5 years. So, yeah, I think that's definitely a strategy that's working for them.
And then my final question, where do you guys see the sneaker industry being 20 years from now?
You want to start, Gene?
Wow. The sneaker industry 20 years from now, I think you'll have artificial intelligence. There'll be, if any brick and mortar, there'll be very few. There'll be like amusement park scenarios. I'm going to leave that to the storyteller.
From my perspective, I think you'll see more indie brands with athlete designer partnerships direct, going directly to consumer. I think experiential will be on a whole different level, you know, migration of PE class, a public park, and retail. I think from a storytelling point, it'll get even deeper. I think the designers will be more celebrities than they are today, so there'll be more Tinker Hatfields, so to speak. I think those are the buckets, to me from a core standpoint. And I think with the effectiveness of the sneaker industry must die, it will be the most diverse, inclusive, as well as empowered industry that we know within that time period.
All right, gentlemen. Well, thank you all so much for joining me this morning. It's been a pleasure talking with you all both.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it, sir.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that's piqued my interest. For this week's Parting Shots, I want to send my prayers and condolences to Lauren London and the family of Nipsey Hussle. Nipsey was a musician and also a community activist from Los Angeles, California. He was murdered back in March at his store that he opened up in his community. And this was a really big story in the news for a number of weeks. The funeral received major national attention, and it was held at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. So I didn't have a chance to reflect on this earlier, but I definitely wanted to send my prayers and condolences again to the family and friends of musician and rapper Nipsey Hussle. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to our guests today. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.